Blog Talk Radio.
Good morning, everyone. This is Johnny Tan, author of From My Mama's Kitchen, Food for the Soul, Recipes for Living. Welcome to my weekly From My Mama's Kitchen talk radio show. My guest for this morning is New York Times bestselling author Kathleen Flynn. Kathleen and I will be discussing her newly released book, Burnt Toast Makes You Sing Good. It is her memoir about food and love from an American Midwest family weaving three generations. Good morning, Kathleen. Welcome to From My Mama's Kitchen Talk Radio. How are you doing this morning?
I'm great, and thank you so much for having me.
I'm so excited to have you on the air. It is a pleasure to have you calling from Mexico. So tell us a little bit about that.
Yeah, so I am actually at a place called Rancho La Puerta, and I come here once a year, and I work as a guest chef. So what I do is I actually teach cooking and really... what they believe here is so much what I believe. It's really kind of a place focused on wellness and eating healthy, and they have this massive organic garden. And it's kind of funny that we're talking about the book when I'm here, because being here and going and walking around the garden reminds me so much of the farm that we lived on when I was a little girl, which is the subject of the book. It seems very circle of life kind of thing, you know what I mean?
Right, right. So, in other words, it is not Hell's Kitchen in any way, right?
No, not at all.
Well, Burnt Toast is a very interesting book. It's very entertaining. The book is very well written. I have to tell you, you have a knack for storytelling. It took me back in time, giving me the opportunity to reminisce my childhood years growing up in Malaysia. So, thank you very much for that. Congratulations.
Oh, thank you. And it's interesting how many people, I mean, this book is set in Michigan and, you know, the American Midwest, and how many people have reached out to me since they've read the book and said, oh, this reminds me exactly of growing up in Brooklyn or in France you know, when I grew up in the Swiss Alps or, you know, on the west coast of the United States. And, and it would seem like, you know, this book that's about sort of this very kind of classic Midwest upbringing wouldn't even think it would resonate with people, but instead it really does. And I think that food and food writing in particular has a way of drawing people in and, you know, that kind of commonality of the family meal and cooking and that sort of thing. I think that's one of the things I love about food writing, is that you can really touch people in a way that I think just writing, say, a straight out memoir, you wouldn't necessarily get to those places as easily.
So true. As we discuss further in the show, people will see that how food plays an important role in family lives, family values, and basically apart from being the sustenance of life that sometimes we take for granted in so many ways. So let us get started by getting to know you a little better. Please give us a quick walkthrough of your life from childhood to the present moment.
Oh, sure. And that's such a great story. As a question to people, it says, right, so just tell me about, you know, what's happened to you since, you know, you were born. But it's kind of surprising because it's very effective, because you were like, okay, well, I was born in, you know, and it's so, I don't think we try to get to know the totality of people very often. So I actually was born my family was living on a farm in Davidson, Michigan, which is in Michigan. It's outside of Flint, about an hour north of Detroit. And we had a farm at that time. We lived on a farm until I was about seven or so, and then we moved into what I call town, which was really a small little kind of 1,200 people living in this sort of small town. Lived until I was about 11, and my father was diagnosed with cancer when I was about nine, and I didn't know that. No one ever actually told me that my father was sick. I kind of knew he was sick because he went to the doctor and he didn't go to work, and you know, but I never really knew any of the particulars. And when I was 11, he became very gravely ill, and his doctor advised him that he needed to move to a warmer climate. And my family had purchased a second home in Florida that they were actually using as sort of a rental second income kind of property. And so he moved there. and then I moved down with him, and my mother stayed in Michigan. So I lived for about a year with my father, and during that time, he went into remission, and I was about 12 years old or so, and that was a hugely formative time in my life. I really got to know my father in a way, and I think that normally at that time period, our relationship would have been very different if he hadn't been sick, but instead he really treated me like an adult, and we had a lot of adult conversations, and I'm kind of very grateful. I was also a complete social outcast at school, so that was very helpful because I didn't have any friends to like bother me or to go to after school. But he passed away when I was 13, and my mother by then had moved there, and so my mother and I lived at home alone, and my mother was a single parent, and I really connect with people who grew up in a single-parent household because of those years of living with my mom. But when I was 18, I threw a dart at Matt, and it landed in Gary, Indiana. And no one would willingly move to Gary, I don't think. And so I moved to Chicago when I went to college, and I studied journalism at Columbia College in Chicago and earned a bachelor's in journalism and started writing for like the Chicago Sun-Times, where I was a stringer. I was a freelancer, and I interned at Playboy magazine, which was fascinating, and really started my journalism career then, and then went back down to Florida, where, you know, in the early 90s, people kind of forget there was a recession then too, and there were a lot of layoffs in the journalism industry, and kind of the beginning of the decline, I think. So I got a job. The only job I could get was writing obituaries in Sarasota, Florida, which I will tell you is a very busy job. I say old people live in Miami, but their parents live in Sarasota.
Right.
So I did that for about a year and a half, and that was probably the best job I ever had. I really had to learn how to describe people's lives in a very short period of time when I would write the feature obituaries, like write actual stories about them. I learned to interview people at the worst time of their life, you know, when they had just lost someone. And it has made me a much better interviewer. I think that anyone who wants to be a writer should really have to go through that process of writing obituaries. There's a reason why. So, like a lot of journalists, you know, and talk about their days of when they had to write obituaries, and it was, you know, hugely formative for me too that time period. And then I became a reporter and covered crime and covered, you know, cops and you know, all that stuff and education and all the usual stuff. And about that time, I figured out I didn't want to be a reporter. I wanted to be a food writer, and started writing about food, and that was about 1994 or so. And right when I was trying to get a job as a food writer, which I found was very difficult thing to do because there weren't very many food writing jobs, someone hired me to go start an internet magazine. I was really into the internet. I was very geeky. And so I did that, Internet Underground. Very proud of that time period. It was a very fun magazine. We called it Spy Meets Wired. And although all of us who actually worked at the magazine were hopelessly uncool. But it was fun. We talked to all these people who had websites, and, you know, and a lot of people weren't, I mean, it's kind of hard to imagine it now, but only 5 to 10% of people actually had email addresses in 1995. It was just such a new thing, and the web was new, and it was just kind of all Wild West territory. And from there, I actually had someone from Microsoft call me and ask me if I was interested in working at Sidewalk.com, which was their new series of city guides. And I said, is there a food writing job involved? said, yes. So it turned out I was the first food writer hired by Microsoft. So my job was to be the food and restaurants editor for what then was a prototype for what Sidewalk became, because it was before we actually launched it. And then I stayed and continued to work on Seattle Sidewalk after it launched. And it was a great job. I was just fantastic. I mean, we could interview anybody who was interesting in the food world in Seattle or beyond. And I spent $160,000 of Bill Gates' money eating out in restaurants in Seattle, writing about it. It was fantastic. And I really loved it. And we ended up having full sidewalk.com staffs in about a dozen cities, and then we had kind of what called Sidewalk Lights in like about another 47 cities. And then I went to work one day, and I found out that they had sold Sidewalk to our competitor, City Search. And big moment. Really didn't see that coming. And that was 1999. And at that time, I was in really good standing with Microsoft. And so they gave me an option of trying to find another job within the company. And I knew someone who'd worked in the London office. And so I started asking everybody I knew if they knew anybody in the London office so I could go work there. And it turned out that I had three friends who did, and they all knew the same guy. His name was Mike Closar. So I contacted this Mike Closar guy, and he helped me get a job. And I went there and worked as a senior content editor. And by the time I left a few years later, I lived in London for about 5 years. I was in charge of, I was a group manager, and in terms of editorial and stuff. And then I went on vacation, and I came back, and I didn't have a job, but they had eliminated basically anybody to be in charge of content, because they, Microsoft and I think other companies, kind of in their position, I really don't want to just single them out, but they couldn't decide if they were a media company or not. And so every so often they would just get rid of all the content people, and then they go, oh, that was a really bad idea. Let's get all the content. Let's get content people back. And so this was on one of those swings where they went, why do we need content people anyway? And so they had happened. But the curious thing that coming back and finding out I didn't have a job is what led me to go and follow my lifelong dream of studying at Le Cordon Bleu in Paris. And so I went then, and that guy, Mike Closar, he and I had started dating, and he'd moved back to the U.S. already. And when I called him and we talked about it, he quit his job the next day, and he moved to Paris with me. And that's the basis of my first book, The Sharper Knife, The Less You Cry. And I have not had a day job since, and it's been pretty great.
Fantastic.
Now I write books.
Fantastic. The couple of things that I want to let you know, a couple of comments here. Number one is that I think you lost all of the male listeners, including myself, when you said something about your work as an intern at Playboy. We were more interested in finding out.
Yeah, it's funny. So I was actually at America's Test Kitchen and with Chris Kimball, and that was the very first thing he asked me about. He's like, so you worked in Venture with Playboy. What was that like? So anyway, so it was kind of funny. It was a great experience. It was the late 1980s, and they had actually had an intern in a long time, and I was the first one. And it was really a great experience to work with people who are so smart. I mean, they're just terrific editors. I mean, they can kind of pick and choose who they want there, right? I mean, magazine. So I worked with these really smart people, and they had great parties. And I think the thing that set them apart from other places that I worked at before or after, is that they had, like Miss August would show up at, like, the party. You know, just have some random, like, sales party, and there'd be, like, Miss, Miss September, Miss August, whatever. And they also had a bar cart that they kept in the office, which was hugely impressionable to me, too, because I was about, 22. And whenever anybody had a birthday or whatever, at like 4:30 in the afternoon, they'd wheel it out and everybody'd have drinks. And it just seemed very civilized. So, but other than that, it was like working in any other magazine, I think, aside from August and the bar cart, I think.
Well, you made a perfect story because, I mean, American girl from the Midwest, going out and working for Playboy magazine. You see, that's cool. I'm just kidding. The other comment I had is, a long time ago, all my moms actually have said this, the way to a man's heart is through his stomach. Mm-hmm. So what you did with Michael, hey, that's it. You got to cook him a great meal. And his hook, that's it, that's all. That's all she wrote. That's it.
he came along, and when we were living in Paris, and and we had been friends ever when I started working in London. In London, we became friends, but we'd only started dating like a month and a half before I lost my job. And in fact, I was on vacation with him, and I was I had him come down to Florida and meet my whole family, which was a very big deal because I was 36 and unmarried. And my mom was convinced I was never getting married. And she started giving him, like, you know, buying me, like, cookware that, you know, like you give to somebody.
Right,
you know,
right.
And stuff like that. And then she would say, you know, it's okay. You can have cats. Who needs to get married? Right. So when I brought Mike home, and they were just like, wow, she's bringing somebody home. And they, of course, all loved him, thought he was great. And and during that whole, that week that he was in Florida meeting my family, and I watched him interact with everyone, and I thought, wow, I really want to, I remember waking up one morning, and I looked at him, he was sleeping, and I thought, I want to wake up next to him for the rest of my life.
Fantastic.
And
beautiful.
I was like,
story.
I'm going to make that happen. And then, you know, it's like I had this whole plan that I was going to go back to London and I was going to find a job within Microsoft back in the mothership, you know, in Seattle. And he'd moved back to Seattle but was working for someone else at that point. And and then, of course, you know, life really throws you curveballs sometimes. And I went back and I didn't really have that option. I mean, I probably could have potentially have stayed with Microsoft and gotten a job in Seattle, and I did investigate it, but not really after we talked about this whole idea of going to Paris. Somehow, go and study cooking in Paris or go back and work in a cubicle in Redmond.
Fantastic.
So decided,
that's wonderful.
Yeah, make all my food at school and bring it home. So it's great.
That's wonderful. This is the question that all the grandmas and all the moms out there want to know, is that the grandma's Anna's pancakes that seal the deal for Michael?
You know, he actually loves pancakes. And I will tell you that I can, my mother, I think, actually during that week that I came to Florida and met my family, my mother did make him pancakes. I'm sure she did, because she makes pancakes all the time. And he just, and my mother pulled out all the stops, like all the really good food. Like she really was going to nail it because she just really liked him, by the way. So, you know, she made the cornflake chicken, you know, she did the whole everything, all the delicacies of my family.
She pulled all the stuff out, right?
Get some gravy. Oh, yeah.
There you go. There you go. Say, if you marry my daughter, this is what you're going to get.
Exactly. Totally. There's more where this came from.
That's right. That's right. That's right. Wonderful. Wonderful story. Wonderful story. Do you recall your first kitchen experience?
You know, I don't remember exactly my first experience, but I can remember as a 4 year old that they helped, because my hands were so little, that they got me stuffed the turkey, like put the stuffing in the turkey.
Right.
And I can remember that, and we also have a photo of it, which may be why I remember that. But I did it every year after that, because my hands were little and I would just shove, you know, that stuff inside the turkey. And I can, and after that, I remember, you know, helping my mom make like cookies and mashed potatoes, you know. And of course, I learned how to use a knife pretty young, which in retrospect, I think, you know, people are like, what? You give that kid a knife? But I can remember peeling potatoes as a, like a 7 or 8 year old kid. I mean, I was in like first or second grade, but my parents, you know, they just showed me how to use a knife, and they didn't want to do potatoes, and you know, they always looked at kids as like cheap labor, you know, free. So I mean, they never had any qualms about telling us to go do chores. So they're like, here, go pile up something in potatoes. Like, you know, and I can remember sitting around too in Michigan, because we always raised corn. And I can remember probably one of my earliest memories is sitting around shucking corn. Everybody would sit in a circle and shuck all this corn before we had a big meal. And if we had a big family meal. And when I actually, like, sort of smell corn husk, like if I, you know, pick up, like, a corn, I can remember that moment, like that scene. It's a complete image of, like, sitting around with people shucking corn, because they say that, you know, smell is the strongest high to memory. And just that one, just a whiff of corn husk, and I can really remember that. And I can remember the feeling of the air in Michigan during the summer. And, you know, it's a very complete kind of moment.
Very interesting. Did you have a favorite dish when you were growing up?
I did. And, you know, my dad used to make, and this is funny because this kind of started the book, this book that I just published. He made chicken and dumplings. And my mother never made chicken and dumplings, only my dad did. And he learned it from his mother. And my mother, after he died, we never had it again. And I don't know why he never taught me how to do it. I think it was kind of one of his, like, secret dishes. I don't know. But my mother made chicken and biscuits. So I can make my mother's chicken and biscuits, and that recipe is in the book. But I was switching, I don't know, I just had this, you know, sometimes my father died a long time ago, but something will happen, and just really remind me of him, you know, and I'll really miss him. And I was kind of going through that. So I'm going to make his chicken and dumplings. And, Mom, do you have anything, like maybe a recipe, anything, you know, notes or anything? Chicken and dumplings after this, like, over years times. And should, you know, I actually was thinking about that, funny that you mentioned it. They actually have this box, and she brought this box out of her closet. So my mother has, her second husband, my stepfather, was a carpenter, like was a general contractor and carpenter. And so he made her all these closets in the house. She's like 1,700 closets. She's in the closet. But she goes to one of these many, many closets. She goes and pulls down this box. I've never seen the box before. And she starts flipping through it and like looking through it. And she's like, no, I don't even have it. And I was like, what is this, Mom? What is all this stuff? And there were stories that she had written over, you know, 40 years about her life on the farm, and they were all true stories. They were kind of memories that she was putting down, and when they ran the restaurant in San Francisco, stories about my father's life that he told her when he was still alive, and she'd written him down. And I was just stunned. I just was like, wow, I can't believe you never showed these to me before. And she said, well, I'm not a real writer, you know, kind of embarrassed. I don't think they're very good. And I just was kind of gobsmacked by it. And I also thought, Mom, really? How selfish of you. I'm a memoir writer. Material. I can't believe you're holding this back. But she was really generous and let me read everything, and it was amazing. And a lot of it was stuff I didn't know. You know, there were stories I hadn't really heard before, and she had so much detail because some of them she wrote around the time that, you know, they were happening. Like she wrote stories about the farm at the time, you know, while they were on the farm or right afterward and that kind of thing. And so that was really that was what prompted me to write this book. I suppose you could say that chicken and dumplings recipe led to it, which I never could fact, and I didn't put it in the book. I'm still working on it. I just was in Michigan for my book tour, and I talked to some of my family who told me that my dad actually showed her how to make chicken and dumplings. So, because I told this kind of variation on the story, and she said, you know, your dad showed me how to do that. I make chicken and dumplings all the time. So I'm going to get with her and try to see if I can, you know, reveal the mystery. It's the dumplings that always, you know. That's fantastic.
When you mentioned something about your mom writing all this information, all the stories, all her experiences on paper and keeping them, well, when we look back in time, in reading your book, I mean, life is much simpler then. And when I say simple, it's not necessarily that it's not hard, but it's simple in the sense that kitchen, the dining table, became the hub for family conversations, where you learn about your family ancestries and relatives and so forth and all that. So now we don't quite really have that kind of a synergy anymore. And so back then it was very simple. It allows people to get together over a meal, a good meal that is, home cooked, and allows conversation to just naturally take place and roll. So having that in mind, what kind of research did you do on your ancestry? And what did you find out? Did you find out anything that surprised you in some ways?
Yeah, I think that your comment about that is really spot on. I think that, you know, and I love the line that, just to say that it was simpler doesn't mean it was hard, because I think that was one of the things that I did really find was how hard the lives were of some of my ancestors. And I kind of knew that. You know, you always hear the stories about, you know, when I was a kid, I walked them 5 miles in the snow to go to school or whatever. But when I actually did the research and went back and was looking at their lives, and you know, I never realized that my great-great-grandmother arrived in the United States I guess I had never heard that before. She was only 17. I thought she came with her family. But she actually was the first one who came here, and she was 17, and she had won the case, because that's what they recorded on the ship. And, and she had written some letters back to people and, you know, about coming over and track those down. And she told people, she wrote that she didn't speak any English. And so her English. So someone, before she left, gave her one of those books, you know, like English, like phrase books. Hey, you know, kind of the Dunnius Ala Bibliotheca kind of stuff, you know, and except in English. And that's what she studied, and that's all the English that she knew when she arrived in the United States. And she made her way first to Minnesota and then to Michigan. And it was very common for Swedish people to come here during that time. It was in 1890s because if you were, say, a poor person in Sweden, you had the privilege of paying taxes to the monarchy, but you couldn't vote, you couldn't go to school, you couldn't own property, you couldn't do a lot of things. And so so that's why a lot of them came to, they came to the United States, because they could get those things here. And they had about a million Swedish people came to the United States in about the course of around 30 years. And the Swedish government took note and went, this is bad. So we need to, like, kind of sort this out. And they're a much different country today as a result of that mass wave of the exodus of people leaving Sweden in those times. And I didn't know that either. So, but then I really did a lot of research about my dad's family and my, just my paternal grandmother and paternal grandfather, and I found out a lot of other interesting things, including that my last name really shouldn't be Flynn, because my grandfather was a bigamist, and I didn't know that either. That was pretty surprising that he had multiple families, and he explains a lot. He would leave my grandmother alone for years at a time. He was apparently devilishly handsome. In time, apparently. They met because he was, wait for it, he was a roller skater in the circus. That was his job. He did roller skating tricks in the circus. And he met my grandmother, and she's, you know, 17 years old, and he was really good looking. And her father had said, you know, don't do it. And then they did, and they got married, and they had all these kids. And when they had six children, and my dad was the youngest in 1930, he just disappeared. And it was the start of the Great Depression. And so she was left alone with these kids, not having any idea if he was going to come back. He was supposedly out working as a traveling salesman. And all those stories you hear about the traveling salesman, it apparently turned out to be true. So he went and he traveled and sold something other than his kids, apparently, because he got married to another woman and had a whole other family. And then came back to my grandmother in 1932 or 33, just long enough to get her pregnant with one of my aunts, and then left again. And then came back a few years later, got her pregnant again, and then left again. And so so she ended up having to raise all these kids really on her own. And I don't really think I appreciated how hard she worked. And I didn't know the level of poverty that they worked, that they lived in at that time. I mean, I knew that they were really poor, but when I did research, I found out that about half, my father included, that they actually all had major health problems for because they were so malnourished. So my father had rickets. His two of his siblings suffered from, you know, really extreme vitamin B deficiency. I don't even think they quite really knew what that was at the time, but they, so, you know, so it kind of really made me realize just, you know, how valuable nutrition is in a family, and that, you know, they didn't have it because they just simply had no money. They really, he thought it was normal that he would go to bed at three. He thought everybody did. And I think I was it really gave me a lot of respect for my grandmother, that she had to go through all that, and what a tough person she is. And I never really knew her because she died before I was born, and I wish I had. So those were, I think, those stories, and I think the other one was that I found out that my maternal grandfather, who I had known, had worked as a cook in the Army. He had been based at Fort Sam Houston, San Antonio, Texas, during World War One.
Yeah.
But it wasn't until I was doing the math when I was working on this book that I wondered, that's kind of odd. So Grandpa, he would have turned 18 at the first year of World War One. Why didn't he go to the front lines? And it turns out because he was a bootlegger. So he had been arrested for making and selling homemade whiskey and had been caught and had been in jail. And so when he was 17, and so when he got called before the draft board when he was 19, they didn't allow him to fight because he was a convict. And so he was sent, and it turns out that if anybody listening to this has some grandfather or some other relative who worked as a cook during a war, that's often the case, is that they were not eligible to fight. And so they ended up getting those people and having them work on the base. And a lot of the Army cooks, that was the case. And that was also very surprising. But I'm very grateful to Moonshine, because if it wasn't for Moonshine, then maybe, you know, I wouldn't be here. Because he might have just gone to war and been killed, you know, like so many other young men during World War One. So kind of saved his life, turns out.
Yeah, yeah. Did you decide to title the book Burnt Toast Makes You Sing Good?
Yeah, so the original original title of this book was going to be The Farm on Coldwater Road. And it is now a chapter title, but I thought it seemed really passive, and when I was working on the proposal for the book for my publisher, I wanted something that was a lot more active sounding and something that really caught kind of the spirit of my family and of that time period, and, you know, just the kind of tough hardness of them, and yet their humor, because they're very funny, kind of eccentric group of people. And my mother said it one morning, because it's something my grandmother always said, was burnt toast makes you sing good. Everybody knows that. And it was her way of just getting, you know, the kids to eat the burnt toast. And we all can sing. But, I mean, we're not like the Von Trapps or anything, but we can't all kind of sing. And so I don't know if that's the case or what. But she said it one morning to someone and said, oh, I burned the toast. Well, I guess I'll eat it because it'll make me sing good. And I thought, that's a good title, because it's something you'll remember. And to me, I thought it was very metaphorical as well, because it's sort of this idea, to me, it's along the lines of what doesn't kill you makes you stronger, which is something else my grandmother used to say. And sort of this idea that, you know, you kind of go through these hard times, but, you know, it makes you a better person. And so to me, that was when I kind of thought about it, particularly as a metaphor, I think it was perfect. And it was a little bit of a sell to my publisher, because they desperately wanted to fix the grammar for a bunch of editors. But then I decided to make it so deeply embedded into the narrative of the book that they couldn't change it. And I also later found that I had written this, I had a lot of writings. They were all in a suitcase, and the suitcase got sold at a garage sale. My stepfather took everything out and it was never seen again. But I did find a few book reviews that I wrote. One of them was for A Tree Grows in Brooklyn. And then the book, at the end of the very end of the book, I have an excerpt of this actual book review I wrote when I was 13. It was after my dad died, and I didn't realize it. It was after I had decided on the title of the book that I mentioned Burnt Toast Makes You Sing Good in it. And I didn't even make that connection. It was so odd when I saw that. I thought, that's really weird. I don't even remember writing that. So it just seemed like there was some sort of universe thing that brought me to the title. So.
Very interesting. Well, certainly it combines the three generations together. So that's very, very exciting. How did your family respond when they heard that you're writing the book?
So they, I don't think they really realized that they were, I don't think they kind of got the whole thing initially until I sent them the full manuscript. Because I interviewed everyone and talked to them. And I've written two books. So I think to them they realized, like, oh, it's going to be like a real book, you know. but then I, you know, as my sister says, don't get drunk with a memoir writer. And we ended up talking about all this stuff about when she was a clown and now she's going to be a clown. And I said, that's a great story. I'm putting that in the book. And so they were all really, really great with it. I mean, I think to them, they were happy to capture that time period of living in the farm in particular. Mm-hmm. And they're kids in the book through most of it. So I think to them, it's not really revealing very much about their personal lives. There's one chapter in what it's toward the end called Don't Tell Her Parents, and they're all teens or very, very early 20s. And that was, they were kind of like, oh, no, those are funny stories. That's great. Don't really do that again. You know, so you get kind of the license to write up to basically what you included in this book. And then, you know, we don't want anything else. They didn't want to be like the David Sedaris treatment of their lives. Yeah. But they were all really good with it, so, which was great. It was interesting, too, in talking to all of them to see, you know, kind of, they all had very different perspectives of things that happened. And, you know, and it's kind of tricky working off memory anyway, but then you're, you know, dealing with a lot of people's memories of the same event. You kind of see it from a lot of different perspectives. And that was sometimes really helpful and also sometimes very difficult because I had to decide whose kind of truth I wanted to pick. Because sometimes they were completely at odds with one another. Not very often, only in a couple of cases. But then I have to decide, like, well, which truth do I want which version do I want to have? Because that's what people will see and read, and that will be consumed as the truth. And I was lucky because there wasn't very much of that. You know, generally speaking, I think most people had a pretty similar sort of set of recollections about events and that sort of thing.
Were there challenges in putting the book together in the sense that I know the theme is the importance of preserving family stories and recipes for future generations? Were there challenges in the sense that how did you come up with these recipes and these are the things that you want to talk about and so forth?
Yeah, so I kind of, when I was putting the book together, that's actually a really good question because I think people tend to think that recipes are sort of this thing you just sort of throw in and tag in to the end of the chapter. And maybe it is for other people, but it's not for me. So it has to be very, you know, something it's very contextual and the recipes take a lot of time. I mean, you know, to go and you know, research them, find them, get them. I have to test them. I have to make sure they're, you know, stuff that's readily available. And then I have about 150 volunteer recipe testers who test everything and they fill out surveys. And every in all my books now, and in Burnt Toast included, every recipe has to be tested at least 10 times. So by the testers. And so it's kind of a big, you know, effort to put the recipes in. So, and in some cases, recipes that I thought would be really important recipes, like goulash was a really big one. Some people call it like chili mac and stuff like that.
Right.
And I made my family's version of goulash and my testers, half of them hated it. And my husband didn't like it. So I tried making it again and then, you know, tried different versions of it and just, I could never get any, but I mean, it just, so it's in the back of the book, one version of it, but I couldn't put it like front and center into a chapter. But in terms of things I picked, some of it I really wanted it to be chronological and some of it is not really very chronological. It's just sort of, these are kind of recollections are pulled in or stories that are pulled into chapters like fishing and deer hunting and canning and stuff like that. And I really wanted to capture sort of, you know, elements about food that were particularly, you know, things like canning that were really tied to that sort of time period, but are also kind of timeless. I mean, you know, people in Michigan still go deer hunting, you know, they still go fishing. Some people still can, and canning is having this huge revival. And, And I really wanted to capture those, you know, kind of how those activities were so important to my family, you know.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, my dad went hunting every year and got a deer. And, you know, he did it because, you know, it's kind of this male bonding thing. But he also did it because we needed the food, you know. I mean,
we
ate it all.
Right.
Took it and got it processed. And, you know, we always fished. All of our vacations were fishing vacations. My dad loved fishing, but it was also a great way to catch food and keep the kids quiet, because he told, you know, he'd say, well, if you can't be quiet, you can't go fishing. So I said it was a very economical way to, like, entertain kids for hours. So I think I wanted to capture sort of this this experience, you know,
right.
kind of a 360 view of their kind of experience by finding activities that were very kind of elemental to their lives. And so if I was, say, writing it about growing up in Maine, I probably would have a chapter about lobstering, or, if it was in Florida, you know, maybe going shell glocking, or, you know, whatever. I think that they're just those, you know, activities or experiences that people have that are just very, very kind of sum up a lot of their childhood. And that's how I selected a lot of those. And then the recipes kind of fell into place, or didn't in the case of goulash.
Interesting. Very interesting. What were the favorite moments you experienced in composing the book?
My favorite moments?
Yeah.
I would say I really liked learning about my ancestors. I think that I didn't know them. You know, I didn't know my paternal grandparents at all. And definitely never met my great-great-grandparents. And they were such interesting people. I think the other thing that I kind of was my favorite takeaway from the whole book was my remembering what kind of this life of generosity my maternal grandparents lived. And it really reminded me of that. And I think it really changed my perspective on life, really kind of going, I mean, I knew that they were very generous people, but when I was really writing about them, it really struck me, you know, that, you know, my grandfather used to say, when you leave this world for a better land someday, the only thing you get to take with you is what you gave away.
Mm-hmm.
And he gave away everything. Like, he, you know, always had a big farm. He gave away lots and lots of food. He gave away, grew beans and dried them, gave away lots of beans. I mean, he just would, you know, gave and gave, because he really used to say, you know, the funny thing about generosity is you can't give it away, because it always comes back to you. And it was true.
Right.
People gave them everything. You know, they would leave books, they'd leave magazines. I mean, some guy gave him a dog. I mean, and my grandmother used to do something called sunshine work, which was, you know, just really thoughtful things that she did. And she didn't tell people about particularly. And she did it without the idea of it, you know, kind of being a good deed. Like, oh, I'm doing it because it's my karma. She really expected literally nothing in return. She just did it because it was a nice thing to do. And when she died, there were hundreds of people at her funeral. She lived in Sanford, Michigan, and there were only 800 people who live in Sanford, but she had 900 people who came to either the visitations or to her actual service. And a lot of them were people my family didn't even know, because she had helped them out, and she never told anybody. It was so interesting.
Right.
And I think that, you know, there's a lot of bad news lately, it seems like. To live a more generous life is something I really took away from doing the research for this book.
Well, the interesting thing about it back then, wealth is measured in a very different way as well. Now, when we talk about wealth, we're talking about material wealth. Back then is a person's generosity. What are they able to give? And to me, in all actuality, that's priceless. The giving of time, the giving of favors, the things that you are helping someone in a time of need, basically. And that's what your grandparents went through, and what my parents, I guess in some ways my grandparents as well. So they have a different perspective about wealth. As long as I'm willing and able, I can move, I can drive a nail, for lack of a better term, cook something, that's what I'm going to give someone who is in need. If you recall, I mean, you travel extensively now, if you look at it, mm-hmm. what's the best way to really create the atmosphere of connecting with people? A simple smile. And the very next mm-hmm. thing, believe it or not, is the offering of food.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah, definitely. I think that food plays very strongly in that. I mean, if I think about what my grandparents gave away, I mean, my grandparents really didn't have any money.
Yeah.
And my parents didn't either. But, you know, it seemed like the thing that they had was, you know, they'd have a big garden or they had a lot of stuff they canned or, you know, my dad would give away fish to people when they went fishing,
mm-hmm.
you know, and it just was, or he helped people, you know, hunting. Because for a lot of people who are hunting, you know, I mean, you know, that was, they also were relying on catching a deer for food and kind of sadly, my dad was a really good hunter because he'd been in the Marines, you know, during Korea.
Yeah.
And unfortunately he had a lot of experience with, you know, hunting in the cold. And so, I think that is really true. I mean, I think there is sort of an intimacy that you create with people when you can bond over food.
Yeah. They grew up in the generation that they don't waste anything. They appreciate
mm-hmm.
what they have. And so rather than letting it just sit by idle, if that will make a difference in someone else's life, hey, we've done something positive.
Yes, exactly. And I think that that's a great point because I think one of mm-hmm. the things that I really want people to take away from the book is the value of food.
Yeah.
And, you know, the average American family wastes about 30% of the food that they bring home. And, and I can't say a typical family because it's not really exactly an average. But then, you know, one out of six children in the United States lives in a, you know, in a food insecure environment. So I think, you know, it's kind of funny because we have this sort of food is everywhere and food is so cheap that it's lost some of its value. I mean, it's really different, you know, when you raise something, you know, like I raised kale this summer on my back porch and tomatoes are always kind of a disaster in the Northwest in Seattle. but my kale came up and it was beautiful. And it's funny, you know, like I'll buy kale and, you know, I try to waste food anyway, but, you know, the kale that I grew in my garden, it's really valuable. I spent a long time growing it. You know, I had to deal with, you know, keeping the squirrels away from it and, you know, whatever, and I grew it and I watched it grow. And I think that connected element to the food, you know, to my kale, it really does change how you look at it and how you view it, and that it has more value than something you just picked up and paid for. And you know, that's why I always think for people who, you know, want to incorporate more sort of healthy food or organics or stuff, you know, get an earth box and grow some food. It's actually really fun. And if you have kids, it's fantastic because they learn, you know, they get, you know, I was talking to this woman, actually, not this year, but another year here at this ranch where I'm teaching, and she was surprised to find out that onions grow in the ground. I don't know where she thought they grew, but it was so funny. She's like, I pulled it up. But she's like, oh, my gosh, it's an onion, like stunned. Like, wow. It's so amazing. But I think it's, you know, I think because we don't see food that way, you know, we don't ever see it in natural environments, kind of, you know, really all kind of sexied up and put out and like, you know, piled in the supermarket. And the stuff that doesn't look good doesn't get there. So it's really interesting.
Yeah, so true. Coming back to your creative energy, does the creative energy from the kitchen flows over into your ability to be an effective storyteller?
That's a great question. And I think it does because, you know, you kind of think about cooking, I mean, and writing and stories are sort of similar. I mean, a story starts, you know, with sort of either a dilemma or sort of a, you know, situation, and then you kind of move into obstacles or, you know, sort of the idea of there are events and incidences and, you know, and then you have a conclusion, right, in a story. So if you think about dinner, it's the same way. I mean, you kind of start out with dilemma, what do I want for dinner? And then you look in the fridge and then you say, like, oh, and your obstacles are, oh, darn it, I don't need chicken stock or, right, you know, amount of onions.
Yeah.
And then, but you overcome that and then you, you know, then you kind of find solutions and then the conclusion is dinner. So I think that that's true. I think that there's sort of a natural narrative that flows in everything you cook and everything you make. You may not think of it, but I think it, it does sort of mirror storytelling. I think that's one of the reasons why I like cooking and writing about food so much, because, you know, they really feed each other.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Very interesting. You have lots of pictures in your book as well. When I say lots, as in quality pictures in terms of your family, snapshots, and, of course, captions and so forth that goes with the black and white. And they're just wonderful pictures. Again, it's walking down memory lane. One particular picture that I like to point out is a photo on page 51. Share with us that experience that was captured in that particular photo.
And that's the that's from Playing Chicken, is that right?
Yes, that's correct.
Yeah. So so that photo is actually, it's kind of funny. We don't have any photos from the farm, or very many of them, because my mom had put them all into photo albums. And then she stored them in one of her many, many closets. And but she put it in the closet near our water heater. And our water heater exploded and ruined all the pits. And she didn't realize, actually, that the water or just the wetness from the whole water heater disaster, that had seeped into these photo albums and ruined all these photos. And so that photo is actually a picture. I wanted desperately a picture of my parents' chicken coop. And we had all these pictures of the chicken coop. And Mom standing in front of the chicken coop. And obviously, you know, whatever. So I went around to all my relatives. Said, I need a picture. Do any of you have a picture of our coop? And none of them had one. So, but my aunt, who lived down the road from us, also had a chicken coop. And it was very much like our chicken coop. And so she had a picture of my grandmother, Inez, standing in front of the chicken coop with my two cousins, Pam and Julie. And I think it's a funny picture. They're so proud of it. They're just proud of this chicken coop. Like, and I think they had gone through and rebuilt the chicken coop, and so they're standing in front of it. But it's a funny picture because I think, like, wow, you know, it's just a bunch of chickens in this coop. But I think that it shows, like they weren't standing in front of, like, their new TV, you know, or their new car. I mean, it was part of the chicken coop, and it was something that was really important to them. And so I love that picture. I actually have that picture framed on my writing desk, and I look at that picture all the time.
Very interesting. As someone who grew up on a farm, and of course you appreciate the quality of ingredients, natural ingredients and so forth, what advice would you give to home cooks looking to incorporate more local foods?
Yeah, you know, I actually have a you know, there's a great program that's available in a lot of communities now, and it's called Community Supported Agriculture, or CSA. And, you know, if you kind of go into a search engine and put in CSA basket, you know, and you're where you live, you know, hopefully you'll be rewarded with a number of options. But basically what you do is you pay ahead of time, you know, you'll pay for basically the service of getting these baskets delivered, or sometimes you pick them up depending on where they are, but they'll be filled with all this produce, and it helps out the farmer because it really helps them, you know, have money at the beginning of the harvest as opposed to having to wait until the whole harvest is complete to sell their products. And so, you know, they can then, you know, pay for all their seed and their labor and all that kind of stuff. But it's kind of fun because, you know, a lot of times I get a CSA basket and, you know, you pick it out and you're like, what is this? So it makes you better cook. You get to figure out how to cook, you know, like, you know, different greens you might not know about. But you really end up getting a lot of local produce that's very seasonal. And it's usually a good value because I find that you typically get more than what you're promised because they have to underpromise because they just don't know what the harvest will be like.
Sure.
But I've talked to many farmers who are involved with CSA programs, and they said they're so grateful to the people who support them that, you know, they tend to over-deliver. And that's a great way to go. And growing something, you know, getting, like I was saying earlier, just getting, you know, some containers, I mean, 5-gallon buckets. I mean, it doesn't have to be fancy. You don't have to have, you know, expensive raised beds or anything. And, you know, putting some dirt, you know, doing some research. And if you have kids, you know, get them involved. It's exciting. It's exciting process to grow things and then eat it. I mean, it really, I think, makes you feel that kind of sense of pride. And I think you also get a sense of how much work goes into, say, those carrots that you're sitting in your fridge that you were thinking you just throw away, you know. So, but then you can control whether or not you use pesticide, which, you know, you don't really need pesticide, you know.
Right.
A little soapy water goes a long way. That's what my that's what my parents use, my grandparents use, and, you know, and then you just make sure you wash all your vegetables really well.
Fantastic. Where can someone go to buy the book, get more information about you, and keep up with your latest happenings?
Yeah, so they can go to, they can just type in KathleenFlynn.com, and it's F-L-I-N-N, or, which will take them to my website, or they can just directly type in CookFearless.com, and that's actually the name of my site. I have a newsletter, and it comes out about once or sometimes twice a month, and it's kind of chatty, and I share, you know, what's happening, what my events, you know, if I have any events coming up. I also talk about books, particularly new books that have come out by people I know or ones I like. And I give a lot of stuff away. Presently, I'm giving away a box of stuff from my kitchen. But there are actually some really good quality products in there. There's some like Green Coast Crisp and some, you know, some homemade jam. And, you know, I think I threw in a paring knife. You know, there's just collecting stuff and shipping it out. And they can also buy books. There are links to all three of my books there. So, and they can even order one signed if they'd like. So, no charge.
Wonderful.
Thanks.
How has writing Burnt Toast impacted you personally?
How has writing affected me? You know, it's funny. I always wanted to be a writer. I can't actually remember wanting to be anything else other than wanting to be a chef. So it turned out I did both. I figured out a way. But I started writing stories when I was 8, and I put together my first book when I was 9. I used freezer tape. I'm sure most people don't know what that is now, but it's the binding. And I wrote science fiction. I don't really write in that genre anymore. But I remember the feeling of finishing that book, and it was probably like 20 pages or something, but it seemed like a thing. And I thought, that's what I want to do. When I grow up, I wonder how you figure out how to write a book and get somebody to publish it. And the great thing now is that there's so many, I think it's such a wonderful time to be a writer, because you don't have to wait for necessarily for someone to kind of, you know, let you through the gate. You know, independent publishing is really taking off. I'm a huge advocate of that. You know, you can have a blog and share your stories. I mean, I just think there are so many. And, you know, you can even have your own radio show. I mean, it's wonderful, I think.
Right.
So
right.
I think, you know, humans need stories. I mean, it's really something they gravitate toward. And I think we can never have too many stories. So I really encourage anyone who's a writer or has short stories to tell, but just, you know, to make that happen and just do it.
Fantastic. Wonderful. What is next for you?
I'm working on another book. Actually, I'm working on 4.
I'm
working on 2 simultaneously, and then I have a couple more that are in the works. And and I'm in the process of putting together some events that I'm going to try to do across the United States. One is really a series of events about inspiring women, and the other one is another one, a series of writing classes to really encourage people to kind of share their lives and their stories, but through food writing.
Fantastic.
Kind of doing what I did in this book, which is capturing, you know, their family histories and that sort of thing, or just about places they've gone, sort of culinary travel writing as well.
Fantastic. That sounds really wonderful. We're coming close to the end of the hour. Since our show is about people, family, and living life, would you like to share a recipe for living with our listeners this morning?
Yeah, and it's interesting. We touched on that a little earlier. And I would say, you know, my recipe for living is pretty simple. I think be generous. You know, just whenever you can be. I think my grandfather was really right. You can't give it away. I mean, it always comes back to you. And I think that since I've written this book, I have been, you know, and people ask me for advice or help. I mean, I really focus on making sure that I do that. And and I'd say the other thing is, you know, something that was a quote in my first book, which is something my parents always said, which was, life is not a dress rehearsal. kind of a cliche. A lot of people have heard that. But
yeah,
I think a lot of people go through their lives sort of thinking, oh, well, one day I'll do this, one day I'll do that. And then one day never comes. And so I think if there's something you want to do,
right,
just go do it. You know, figure it out. And I found that people who follow their passions, and often when they take risks, oddly, the universe answers you in a kind way. That it makes it all work out one way or the other. And so I'd say be generous and follow your passions. I think that that's kind of the two things I think that really guide me right now.
That's wonderful. Forget cliches. I believe the fact that if something moves you and gets you motivated to do things, then just do it.
Yeah.
That's the way I feel about things. What moves us is what we got to go with. So, Kathleen, thank you for the great recipe for living and for spending this hour with me on From My Mama's Kitchen Talk Radio.
Thank you. I've had such a wonderful time. Thank you.
Wonderful. Wonderful. To all our listeners, thank you for being with us. Please join me in 2 weeks on Tuesday, October 14. My guest will be New York Times bestselling author Chris Atwood. Chris and I will be discussing his latest book, Unleashing the Power of Ritual to Create a Life of Meaning and Purpose. For additional information about this show and future shows, please go to fmmktalkradio.com. Thank you for listening and have a blessed week. Kathleen, it has been a true pleasure. Thank you again. And have a blessed day in Mexico.
Great. Thank you so much. And thank you
for
having me.
Bye-bye.
Bye.